This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm David Kalman in for Pia. Every Wednesday, we bring you a bonus podcast, one hand-picked story from the week's round of the Sunday Magazine that we think's definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sundays. It's on the CBC Listen app. All right, here is this week's highlight. Now to an issue that's becoming increasingly common among the ranks of our country's top universities, museums, and art galleries. I'm talking about pretendians. It's the name coined to describe people who falsely claim Indigenous identity, usually for professional gain. It's also known as race shifting. And although accusations against the likes of Buffy St. Marie, Carrie Bourassa, and Michelle Latimer have brought the issue to the forefront in the last few years, claims like this actually go back centuries. Métis poet and author Katharina Vermette puts the phenomena at the heart of her new novel. It's called Real Ones, and it follows two sisters who inherit Métis identity through their father as they're forced to reckon with the consequences of their white mother being outed as a pretendian. Katharina joins us now from Winnipeg. Hello.
Hello, Tansé.
Very glad to have you here. And I just look at the books you've written in the past, the stories you've told. Pretendian is a bit of a left turn for you. What inspired you to jump onto that?
My usual compulsion of subject where I don't really want to write about it, but I keep thinking about it. And then I have to write. This book I wrote kind of in between the other books and kind of as a break from that topic onto something else that was equally stressful. It just seemed to be one of those subjects that kept coming up in my life over here and over there, and people I was connected to rather, you know, sometimes closely, sometimes not very close at all. And I just wanted to kind of, I'm very slow with my thoughts. I don't post them. I kind of mull them for years and years. So this is my mulling of some of those thoughts, intermixed with a whole bunch of other things, as my books tend to be a bit of a hodgepodge of many different things.
Many different things.
Many different things.
I feel weird even saying what I'm about to say, and yet we live in a time where, on some level, I have to talk about it because we are talking about pretendians. You are a registered citizen of the Manitoba Métis Federation. There have been no claims against your ancestry. I just want to put that down.
As far as I know, yeah.
So as long as you know, yeah. And I just want to be clear because often we talk about this and we're talking about it with people who have had their ancestry challenged. And there have been a number of examples in Canadian history. I mean, we can go back to Grey Owl. I remember doing a report in grade school about Grey Owl. Really, Archibald Bellany, popular writer, public speaker, conservationist in the early 20th century. He said he had Apache heritage. He didn't. He was British. He is among the early high-profile examples. But what do we know about people who have race-shifted throughout history?
We know a bit. We know things here and there. We know that I know Phil DeLoria years ago wrote a book called Playing Indian. And in it, he really was just surmising that idea of how we're at once destroying cultures, but also then appropriating cultures and almost adorning them as if they're costumes, but at the same time, you know, leaving the persons that are actually living those cultures in absolute, you know, genocide. So I think that I don't know how I can answer the question because I don't consider myself an expert. What I'm talking about here is what I really wanted to focus my book on is the impact it had on us. Because I think we talk so much about and I'm fascinated by it. I'm like, why does someone do that? What could possibly be their motivations? That's where I started from in this writing. But so many things happen when you're writing fiction, especially because you can make stuff up and change things as you go, which is why I love fiction. I wanted to talk more about the impact it has. You know, my characters are so often extensions of myself. They, all of them are, even the bad ones. And I really wanted to talk more about what impact it had on them. You know, these two Mitchiff professionals who are, their identity is not under question, but they just are constantly under siege and under attack and having to defend themselves through no fault of their own.
Let's dive into the book, because you talk about the two sisters, the two professionals, but they suddenly have to grapple with their mother's outing, if you will, false claim to Indigenous ancestry. How do they deal with the consequences of that?
Well, therein was really where I was really interested in, and the kind of cycles that I've gone through when this happened, because I think particularly as Mitchiff people, because there's so many, you know, misconceptions about our culture and this idea that we're half or we're not whole. So it kind of becomes this kind of entry point or gateway, if you will, to claiming Indigenous identity, you know, that misrepresentation of what it means to be Indigenous and to, you know, experience an Indigenous life. But really, not all of us live in these very firm identity, you know, bubbles. And so often we're in these positions, and I've been like this myself. I've always been a proud Mitchiff person, but also I've grappled with owning that pride and owning that identity of myself and having to be out and proud as an Indigenous person has been a struggle for many, many reasons. So then to have that identity then fall into question so many times, it really, I think, for these sisters, and what I was exploring is that doubt of your own identity and really having to strengthen that idea of who you are.
Of course, the fraud is not alleged to be one that they perpetrated. It's their mother. I know you thought about writing the book from the third perspective, from the perspective of the mother of Renee, and you didn't do that. Why did you take that path?
It's where I started from, because I'm so often looking at the perceived villain of the story and wanting to get behind what could possibly lead them to be however they are. I think we're all of us made up of so many different parts, and there's always so many reasons for really bad behavior. And I'm curious about that. But in this issue, I think the most profound and I think the most devastating impact of this issue is the space these false claims of identity, Indigenous identity, the space that these, you know, non-Indigenous folks are taking in the Indigenous community is one of the most violent impacts of what they are doing. They're taking up space. They're taking up, it's fraud and theft. They're taking money, but it's also the idea of taking space and sharing a story that is a falsehood. So in that, I didn't want to give this person any more space. She has so much space in her daughter's lives because she is a non-Indigenous person who has raised Indigenous women. And they have had their own kind of reckoning through her behavior. And that's what I wanted to explore. But I didn't want to give her any more, you know, airtime, if as it were.
Let me ask you, because the story you were writing at the time that Buffy St. Marie, where a lot of that was coming out. And of course, this is someone who said she was born on the Paiapot Reserve in Saskatchewan to Cree parents and was a victim of the 60s scoop and then adopted into a white family in the U.S. And then this CBC investigation landed last fall that found her original birth certificate said, no, the adopted family was actually her real family, that she's white and that members of her own family say her story is built on an elaborate fabrication. Buffy St. Marie herself continues to claim that she is Indigenous. But because that is such a high-profile example, how did that influence you as you're putting together these stories?
Well, I'm going to walk away from the sensationalizing of that a little bit. And I don't want to name out anyone in the process of, you know, promoting this book, because I didn't use any one example. I think there's many examples to choose from. And honestly, when that story came out, I was well underway in the writing of this. And again, I wanted to get back to the idea of the impact on us rather than the individual stories. I don't know enough about that story. And I've kind of made a deal with myself that I don't want to name anybody any names, and I don't want to out anybody, and I don't want to call out anyone. My curiosity is in the impact that had. And I know a lot of people that I was surrounded with when these things happen, there's a sort sense of betrayal. There's a sense of questioning, particularly when it's our heroes. We end up wondering not only what impact that has on us, like, you know, for those of us who sometimes have a fragile sense of identity, it's like, oh, if I'm, you know, I believed that person, so then is what falsehood did I believe about my own identity? And then I also come back to that idea of when we struggle with that, how much space that takes up. I always think about these folks and that opportunity they missed of being a really excellent ally. And instead of being that ally and being that champion for Indigenous issues or whatever, they are now, you know, under this guise of having lied to everyone, possibly, potentially. I'm not going to accuse anyone and don't want anyone to sue me.
Yeah, and I hear you. You don't want to name names, and I'm not going to now name names in my next question to you, but it is some of the higher profile examples of pretendians that we have seen recently have been individuals who one could easily argue have done much good for the Indigenous community in their careers, have shone a spotlight on issues, and perhaps that spotlight would not have shone as brightly were it not for their influence. And then they're outed for not being the person that they had long claimed they were. And I'm so struck by your line about the heroes, the idea that when those who fall from such a great height, it's that much more profound.
Well, it is the heroes, and these are the people that are being risen above. And there's many reasons for why folks are risen above over other people, other performers, other, you know, whatever. But again, it's, yes, way to be a champion. Yes, way to draw attention to Indigenous issues. Those are awesome things to do. Those are awesome things we should all be doing at all times, no matter what we're getting out of it. But again, it's that missed opportunity. We don't know that these issues would have been as loudly proclaimed in the mainstream had it not been for this one person. There could have been a whole other person who comes from a genuine Indigenous experience who could have championed those voices. And why not create a system where those folks are honored and those folks are, you know, get the attention that they so rightly deserve rather than give it all to one other person?
You're listening to the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio 1. I'm David Common, sitting in for Pia Chattopadhyay, and this morning I'm speaking with Métis poet and author Katarina Vermette about her new book, Real Ones. And Katarina, this book is about much more than just the damage that pretendians can cause. It is about motherhood and how messy that can be sometimes. And tell me, what inspired you to explore moms and daughters and their relationships?
Oh, I'm always fascinated with motherhood and parenthood in general, both myself as a child of a parent and as a parent myself. I'm really forever confronted with that idea of like, oh, we are not parented. None of us are parented properly and none of us can parent properly. And we're always leaving someone else behind, sometimes ourselves. So in exploring this issue, I kind of walked into that idea of identity and how we form our identity, how we form ourselves and who we think of as ourselves. And as I was talking about cultural identity, I most certainly stumbled upon, as I always do, that emotional existence and really talking about how the other ways in which we're let down through no fault of our own, just walking around in our lives. And for these sisters, it was really thinking about their they had young parents and very immature parents. And sometimes they also, too, are very immature people. So it was really just thinking about how their childhood has impacted them and how that makes them themselves as much as anything else.
This might be a good segue to talk about forgiveness, which is something you tackle. There's this quote near the end of the book from June and Lynn's younger half-sister, and I'll read it. "You don't forgive people for them. You forgive people for you." So when it comes to an issue as big as race shifting, which can seem unforgivable to many, what were you trying to get at?
I think in that context, I was thinking really specific, because in many ways, I kind of meditate of forgiveness in a number of my books. And I think it's a really interesting, I never come to conclusions when I do these things. Sorry, I'm just a bit of too much of a poet for that. I kind of mull over here and then I mull over there. And then I, you know, think about forgiveness in this other way. I don't think we're entitled to forgive anyone for anything. I don't think we have to, you know, stop being angry if we're angry. We don't have to stop being hurt if we're hurt. But when it comes to that idea of forgiveness, when one is ready to forgive, it has nothing to do with the other person. It has nothing to do with what they have done or not done or where their accountability is. I think forgiveness is really an internal process where we're just letting it go inside of ourselves so that we can move on.
You also explore microaggressions that Indigenous people face day to day in your book. And there's this scene where one of the sisters meets with a white colleague. And as she's leaving, this white coworker quite offhandedly says, "I knew you were one of the good ones." How much of an impact can comments like those have on Indigenous people who have worked very hard to get where they are?
Well, again, here I always speak. Again, I take these questions and put them specifically because I can only think of the impact they have on myself and those loved ones that I know have shared certain similar things with me. I mean, for me, it is, where can I talk about micro? I love talking about microaggressions. I love thinking about microaggressions in fiction because it's so, you can just, you know, I'm making up these stories, right? So I can put them in exactly where I know people will notice them. Because I think when microaggressions happen in real life, so often we don't notice. You know, even me, I think back to interactions and I'm like, oh, what happened with that person? Oh, that person was like this. Oh, what must I have done to make them think that of me? And it's not really until later that I realize like, oh, that's where that was coming from. That's where that kind of comment was. And I can think of 1,000 comments that I've received over the years where people just kind of say something offhandedly. And so often we don't notice that. I don't know that it's not malicious. I don't know that they notice that even when they're making them themselves. You know, this was just someone thinking that she was complimenting this, you know, new colleague. She was so grateful for her for taking on extra work. And she could have meant a million things by something like this.
And yet
she meant something very specific by that. I think that we all need to be very conscious of how we go about into the world and how we interact with folks and trying to have as gentle an impact as possible.
I started a conversation by speaking about how this book is a shift from what you've written about before. A lot of your writing has featured physical violence, something that you've written about, and particularly violence against Indigenous women in your hometown of Winnipeg. I am speaking to you on a week that the man convicted of killing 4 Indigenous women was handed 4 life sentences in prison. Let me say their names. Morgan Harris, Mercedes Myron, Rebecca Contois, and a 4th unidentified woman, all killed by this man. What do you make of the sentencing?
Honestly, I didn't. I tend to live in a bubble whenever I possibly can. And this week was one of those weeks where I got to live in a bubble and didn't know about the sentencing.
A protective bubble.
It sometimes is a protective bubble. I think that there's, you know, we should take time off when we can. You know, this world is a brutal place. I remember when this trial happened and it was such a circus. And this person was claiming falsehoods and claiming, like, I think there was a trying to claim for an insanity defense. I'm sorry, I'm losing the proper term to say that. Mm-hmm. He wasn't responsible mm-hmm. for his actions.
And yeah, I know not criminally responsible.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. I know at that point, I remember feeling just so scared that someone like that could possibly get away with something like that, that this could possibly happen, that I think that he could believe that it could happen is brutal enough in its own. And then I went through the process of feeling really grateful that the judge said, oh, that's absolutely not going to hold water and we're going to do things this way. I felt such relief for the families. And I hope in this sentencing that there is relief for the families, because that is where my heart goes, where my prayers go, and where all of our thoughts and prayers should go. If, at the very least, I mean, what are thoughts and prayers, right? We should also be assisting them in whatever way we can, because the impact that all of this circus must have had on there and the interrupted grieving, I think, is always such a brutal outcome to so much already brutality. So I don't know if I'm only just speaking of my you know, my perspective, such as it is. I mean, I do feel a sense of gratitude, and I'm also really mournful of that gratitude, because we shouldn't feel grateful that someone gets a sense of justice after something so horrific.
So to the book, two real ones. It's a bit of a cliche, but I still would like to ask you, what do you want non-Indigenous readers to be thinking about as they go through this story?
I never prescribe any kind of outcome or morality to anything that I write. My books, fiction, poetry, whatever I end up writing, fiction is the made-up stuff, poetry not so much made up, just kind of distracted. It's really just my mullings of the world. It's really my own, and I only ever speak from my own voice, what I might think of something, my contribution to the conversation, as you say, because I do think literatures, both specifically to communities and also the greater literature, is a conversation we have amongst ourselves. Books, I think, are just little monologues from one person to another, and I think we need lots of books in order to hear a whole story. This is just a tiny contribution. I will say, craft-wise, in this story, I tried to be a little different. I was really leaning heavily on dialogue. I was really playing with the idea of kind of more of a script-based. I was trying to be funny, and mostly that was just sarcasm, because that's how my funny works. But in ways that I wasn't able to be in the other books, because the other books have a very different weight, though I did try to be funny whenever I could.
I adore sarcasm, so you have a fan here just from that. Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. But no, I did try to be a little, I don't know that I get to lighter. I think I'm just a little bit too intense for lightness, but I did try to get a little bit lighter than what I was doing. In the first three novels, I was really exploring something that was a wrestle that I was doing, and it was from a number of different things. And I think that I never want to stop anyone from telling their truth. Sometimes truth is difficult to hear. Sometimes we have to read the brutal, bear witness to the brutality books. And sometimes we got to laugh, and we got to laugh at ourselves. So I was trying to do a little bit more of that. I didn't always succeed because, you know, I get really morose and depressing most
of
the time.
We all try. Yeah, I try. Yeah, we all try against the tidal wave of life.
Exactly. What else can we do?
Exactly. Katerina, thank you so much. Congratulations on the book, and appreciate you speaking with us about it.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
That is Katerina Vermette. Her new novel is called Real Ones. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm David Common. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.